It could be that.
Wednesday. Tomorrow's a Brit.
Tomorrow's a Brit here. Who's? Oh, the Brit. I know who you're talking about. So Wednesday's fine. All right. Let's see. All right, we can begin. It's hard to leave yesterday, Reb Moshe. I mean, do you appreciate those words? I mean, if Reb Moshe is correct, it means every time you announce davening on Shabbos, you're a Mesek Umeitiach. You understand? It's, the world does not accept Reb Moshe. That tshuva, but Reb Moshe, wow. But I understand what's bothering him. We're eradicating Shabbos. We're like the conservative movement. All right. Today we have to go into a different world. Today, Baruch Hashem, is Monday, March 25th, 2019. And I want to say good morning and Boker Tov to the wonderful people in front of me and to those listening across the wide expanse of Jewish existence at this moment in time. I'll talk about that at the end of the year, my recent sojourn in Italy, and particularly in Venice, and share my frustration with you, my aggravation, the question that haunted me all the way home and still does, and then we're going to reward Yomo for being such a good Talmud. And I have to say, the reward is one of a kind. None of you can guess it, and I couldn't even dream it, but it's real. Okay, we mentioned in passing, and Michael, this is a very interesting concept, that a good deal of the irreligious atmosphere of the State of Israel as it was created, and we'll talk about that in the context of Rabbi Young, is the result of Rabbi Cook, that Rav Cook ushered women voting. And in the 1920s, they established the Jewish Agency, and we were one half hour power. All the Chiloniim, all the Mapainikim, all the Mapamdikim, all that whole element. Women voted with men. They were way ahead of their times. And we voted one half of our power. And by the way, these are facts. This is true. So I got an email from my Talmud, Nachum Lehr. Nachum Lehr is one of these guys. Were you in yeshiva with him, or he's younger? He's younger than you. Nachum Lehr is one of these people who knows a great amount of knowledge. So, as the women are voting in the 1920s, I recall reading that for the first election to the Jewish Agency, the religious parties had their votes count double on the assumption that women weren't voting. The other parties protested this wasn't fair. I suppose you can't really blame them. And the system did not last long. I don't think this, I think it was a proposal. I don't think it ever happened to Halacha L'maisa, but it's a fascinating concept. I don't think we should view Rabbi Cook's view as unusual. After all, the first election was in 1920, and even the U.S. only gave the woman the right to vote that very year. Some Western countries followed only years later. Switzerland in the 1970s, and that's true. I was already living here, a citizen, in the well integrated into Israel, and Switzerland finally gave women the right to vote. And we'll come back to that later today. It fits right in. Okay. Now, so we're dealing with Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. There's no question. Have you heard the name Rabbi Dr. Leo Young? We're coming out of left field for you. We're talking about the development of modern orthodoxy in the United States exactly 100 years ago. And the most prominent rabbi who the west side of New York, which until today is a bastion of Torah Judaism, the west side is the west side, the man who, more than anyone else, built it up and gave it its configuration was Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. And Rabbi Dr. Leo Young was Hungarian, trained in Hungary, Germany, England. His father was a Rav in Hungary, afterwards in England. And he arrives in the United States. He's called to a position in Cleveland. And in the early 1920s, he leaves Cleveland to come to New York, becomes rabbi of the Jewish Center. And here's a man who is coming with a PhD from Cambridge, and he speaks English, slight accent perhaps, but a master of the language, and he wants to take on the reform movement and the nascent conservative movement, and he wants to build an Americanized orthodoxy, an orthodoxy which will succeed. And we spoke last week, and I'm going to quote him time and again today. A lot has been written about him. He published a great deal, so we have what to quote. We can quote him in his own words. But to start off with the quote, his goal was to teach Torah to the in the jazz age. You know what the jazz age, the 1920s, the jazz, the music, the singing. It was a world after World War One, endless money, endless happiness. There'll never be a war again. We'll never be poor again. That's what people believed in the 1920s. I need not tell you that the world came to an end just 10 years later, and a year after the 1920s, right at the end of the 1920s, October 1929, the world caved in financially, the depression and all that goes with it, but the jazz age, you got to be positive. And how did he want to accomplish this? So he spoke about the power of speech. The sermon becomes very important. The synagogue, the orderliness, the decorum in the synagogue. And he attempted a day school. That's where we left off last week. And it's interesting, the day school opened up in Jewish Center did not succeed. And it lasted about 10 years and then it went under. Many years later, they organized the Manhattan Day School, MDS, and that is a major institution until today. And I explained that, I just want to reiterate it, and the Rebbe spoke about this many times, and those of you familiar, Moriah Rebbe's sister, Shulamit Meiselman, the mother of the famous Rav Moshe Meiselman, I'll say Rabbi Dr. Moshe Meiselman, but he'll be a little bit upset with me for telling the world he has a PhD from MIT, but the famous Rabbi Dr. Moshe Meiselman, his mother, a very brilliant lady who had the privilege of knowing, she left the memoir, which I trust you're all familiar with, the Soloveitchik heritage, and she writes about this too. And the point I want to stress, these were Orthodox Jews we're talking about. And they were hesitant to send their kids to a day school. We've got to remember, 100 years ago, every Jew in America dreamt of becoming an American, of getting rid of the greenhorn stigma that you're a Johnny-come-lately. It's not Israel. See, again, we're in this room, every last one of us is a greenhorn, is a Johnny-come-lately. Not one of us sitting in this room, maybe you were born in Israel. No, you were not born either. Not one of us sitting in this room. It's not like my grandchildren who were all born in Israel and totally grew up here. And the fact that some of them know English is a miracle, because the language they went to school in, the language they spoke on the street, the language they played the soccer in was Hebrew. But in Israel, it's a country of immigrants. We have nothing to be ashamed of. If anything, we're Anglos. We're, all right, the Yomo is partially Russian, born in Kiev, the Ukraine, but he spent formative years in the United States. We gave up America. It's like, I once had a debate that just came up in my mind this morning, because walking home, I noticed the bench. Again, I took a look. The bench next to my building, which my wife fought for years, and the city finally put a bench in. Then they got a dedication in memory of the Halberstadt family. And they were a family that ran away from Germany in the late 30s. And he once told me off, we have a minyan for maybe 30, 40 years already, Matzoy Shabbos, Matzoy Yontif, we daven in our parking lot. We have a big minyan, people come from all over. There's a minyan a block and a half away, but we can have 40, 50 people Saturday night. And all the shuls are filled, and the other parking lot also has a minyan. So one time he told me off, and Sam Dershowitz, Dr. Dershowitz, were talking English to each other. Lomatam lomadabrim ifrit. So I told him off in a nice way. I said, Tishma Tov, atam barachta me Germania. You ran away from Germany, 37, 38. We came in Aliyah from America. So it's a big difference. Here, we have nothing to be ashamed of. We gave up the American dream, the American luxury, the American language, the American sense of fair play, all that we grew up with in America. Today, it may be a little bit different. I don't want to mention the anti-Semitism in America. Who would dream that in the Congress we'd have anti-Semites and boast about it publicly? But we grew up in a different, we gave it all up. But 1920s, you're going to send your kid to a day school, segregation. And the Rav cried about this time and again. When he began Maimonides, he said, I always feel a debt of gratitude to the four families that joined with me and sent their kids to Maimonides. It took courage. Because everyone said to them, well, your kid will be a greenhorn, your kid won't speak English properly, your kid won't know Shakespeare, how can you be an American? Your kid won't be able to go to college. And that's why these original schools, if you'll talk about Maimonides, or a better example would be Ramaz, if you read their literature over the last 70 years, 80 years, and they're both founded in the mid-30s, they boast about their kids go to Harvard, go to Yale, all right? I don't know, Charlie, did Breuer's boast about the fact that you went to Harvard? I don't think that plays a role with them today. But Ramaz and Maimonides, our kids are accepted into the best university. In other words, what they're saying is, despite the fact the kid had a Torah education, he still was good enough to get into the Ivy League colleges. And this, you have to understand, the Jewish Center failed with their day school. It was too early. And these are from people. See, it's not like you say, well, the people weren't from, they didn't know. These were Jewish Center people. These were Shomrei Shabbat. But they said, Talmud Torah, give us a good Talmud Torah, give us a good supplementary education, but the public school wins out. All right, and now let me go a step further. And here again, I caution you, this explains time and again what later will happen, the bitter battle, the caustic battle between the supporters of Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik and the supporters of Leo Young for the presidency of YU. Time moves on. Again, I don't want to delude myself. If Rakefet would come to New York, and imagine they put up a sign, a graduate of the Yeshiva and Bernard Rebbe Graduate School who is related to our founder, all right? I'm related, and I'm going to speak about Rabbi, the battle for the presidency, all right? If 20 people will show up for my lecture, I will be impressed. But people really don't care. Life moves on. They're at it. Rakefet, what are you crazy? What are you telling us about the 1920s? We're in the 2020s today. You follow me, Yitzchak? But Rabbi Young, look at his background. He came from Germany. He came from Hildesheimer. He studied with Professor Barth. He studied with Professor Hildesheimer. He studied with Reb David Zvi Hoffman. He had smicha from him. And he was totally caught up that the modern approach, science of Judaism, that will captivate the youth in America. And right at this moment in time, the 1920s, what's going on? Yeshiva College. They announce a $5 million campaign to build a new campus, come uptown from the east side, and open a yeshiva college under yeshiva auspices. You have no idea. This was epic making. And some of Rabbi Young's balabatim gave what today would be the equivalent of tens of millions of dollars. When people gave $200,000, the New York Times was flabbergasted. The Hanukkah dinner, I think it was 24, 25, I write about it in Revel. So three gentlemen got up and each one pledged $100,000. $100,000 money. Jack, what would it be worth today? 1924 money.
An ounce of gold was $20. Today, an ounce of gold is about what?
1300. So, Ribbono Shel Olam, take a look at the difference. This is heavy money. And these people, again, gave another $100,000. And you're talking about, among them, the crowd, Jewish Center. I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, if Rabbi Ari Berman, the president today of Yeshiva University, right or wrong, the fifth president, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Revel, Belkin, Lamb, Richard, Joel, Rabbi Berman, my student, five presidents. His biggest problem is fundraising. But I have a feeling if you can make a list over the 100 years, the greatest amount of money came from Jewish Center. And here, Rabbi Young is caught up with the dream that this yeshiva college will be a continuity of Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin. And he spoke, when he would speak about the yeshiva, I quote Rabbi Young, it combined the best of Western scholarship. He's talking about his education in Germany with a full regime of Hebrew text study, and would underlie his vigorous scholarly commitment to Torah im Derech Eretz. You see, his vision of yeshiva, very different than the vision of Mori Urebi, Rav Soloveitchik. If you read my work on the Rav, the second volume, very carefully, so you know I consider it one of my greatest achievements that I found those tapes. You have no idea. I can't even tell the full story. In 50 years, I can speak a little bit more freely. But I can tell you, there was someone who worked for the Community Service Division, and he had reels of some talks the Rav gave for the YU Rabbinic alumni. And here I am, with someone who put a lot of money into this under the light. In other words, it shouldn't be public knowledge because there's family involved, there's vested interest involved. And I remember we were being driven to where this person lives at the other end of the world in Riverdale, near the Hudson River. If I'm not mistaken, it was Riverdale, maybe Yonkers, right near the Hudson River. And we got these reels and I worked on it and I turned them into cassettes. And they were in Yiddish, and I translated them into English. I did them in the Kollel in the early 80s, mid-80s. What talks? But there the Rav lets down his hair and says, what is the difference between my thinking and Rabbi Hirsch's thinking, what went on in Germany? And you see, to define the Rav vis-a-vis Germany is very simple. The German Orthodox unit, people, schools, teachings outside of Rav Hirsch, they viewed scientific Jewish scholarship as the way to go. This is the proper method, this is modernity, this is science, establish proper texts, understand the Talmud in the context of the historical background, understand the foreign words in the context of Greek and Latin. Was an entirely different approach. The Rav's approach was Volozhin, Brisk, Lithuania, Shas, Poskim, no innovations whatsoever. We have to go to college. I'm quoting Rebbe now. The Rav said, we have no choice. The times demand it. But my son, and he says, women are mad at me, mothers are mad at me, we demand too much of our students at Maimonides, what can I do? My own son, he has to learn, then he has to do his homework, he has to do well in his secular studies. But you see, with the Rav, there was no integration. It's very different than Rav Hirsch. I even said publicly, and a rabbi, the one week later, gave a whole talk totally demolishing what I said, but I have to be honest with you, I still hold that my original viewpoint was more correct, was the Rav. The Rav, the times demanded. Rav Hirsch would never say that, right or wrong. Times demanded? You're familiar with the 19 letters? You're familiar with the on Lessing's 100th yard site when Rav Hirsch spoke? Who put us into the ghetto? The Jew doesn't belong in the ghetto. We never chose the ghetto. Yaftalakim li yefet v'yishkom b'yohal Hashem. This is the charge, time immemorial, nothing to do with the 1900s, the 2000s, nothing to do. This is the Jew, you have to live in two worlds. The Rav could very well be, if we didn't have to live in two worlds and we can all go back to the ghetto and sit and learn Volozhin, Brisk, Vilna versus Amol Given, what once was, could be the Rav would be very happy. And I have to tell you, for Haraya, look at some of his descendants. Yitzi Rav Yitzchak Lichtenstein, Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas, grandson of the Rav. No, that's the grandson. Look at Rav Meir Twesky, Rosh Yeshiva in YU, grandson of the Rav. No, you'll ask Rav Meir Twesky, what should I major in? Accountancy or Chinese literature, which attracts me? You know what the answer would be? Very simply, accountancy, it's easy, it doesn't take... Chinese literature will take too much time, you'll have to get a PhD to make a living, it'll take away from learning. Total different approach. Rav Moshe Meiselman, the Rav's nephew, who spent the endless hours with him in Boston, look where he's at. So you see, Rabbi Dr. Young was very loyal to his education, to his alma mater. When he spoke about yeshiva and yeshiva college and what they're trying to do, he really believed that it would be based upon Hildesheimers, what he saw in Germany, not Litter. And you can see a sharp difference developing him between his gestalt and the Rav's gestalt. And again, I come back to the witticism, call it a joke or a witticism as you wish, but when I entered the yeshiva in 1951, which was only a few years after the basic battle for the presidency, the word on the street was, if Rabbi Young would have been elected, there'd be no yeshiva. And if the Rav would have been elected, there would be no college. Well, that's not exactly right. The Rav wasn't opposed to college and Rabbi Young wasn't opposed to yeshiva. But their concepts of what the yeshiva would be, absolutely right. Could you imagine the Rav viewing Hildesheimer in America? This is not a yeshiva, this is not Litvish, this is not Volozhin, this is not Brisk. Rabbi Young, on the other hand, was lost, Volozhin, Brisk. He wasn't raised. He didn't excel in that field. He couldn't go in and give a lumdish shir, you follow? He couldn't give a shir with a diuk and the lashon of the Rambam. He would be busy trying to establish what is the correct reading of the text of the Rambam. Very, very fascinating. Then there's something else about Rabbi Young, and here we come to a world of difference between all of us sitting in this room and the thinking of Rabbi Young. And I have to say, this thinking was not only his, it was Rabbi Young, it was Rabbi Lichtenstein, it was Rabbi Goldstein, to a certain degree, the Rav as well. Oh, my dear students, we all chose willingly to leave the United States, to leave Canada. 100 years ago, Jews that emigrated to the New World, they were the happiest people alive. Freedom. We take freedom for granted. When I worked for the Mossad in Russia, so one of the jokes that made the rounds in Russia was a Russian joke, but I loved it. They tell the story of this American tourist comes to Moscow and he meets his equivalent, also a university professor, and he says to the Russian professor, "We have total freedom in the United States. I can get up on any street corner and say that Nixon is a horrendous president." And the Russian says, "We have the same freedom here. I can get up in any street corner and say that Nixon is a horrible president." And you see, this is something we take for granted, but this, after World War I, the immigrants, My own grandparents, when I went in Aliyah, my grandfather had learned in Volozhin. Could you imagine? My grandfather could quote Gemaras by heart. All right, America destroyed him. What remained of Yiddishkeit, all right, at least the home was kosher, that much. And I never knew how much my grandmother suffered till tens of years later, I learned the family she came from. I knew name, I knew the Kalvariski name, but I didn't know what a family that was. That's right. The Rosh Hashiva of Hebron across the street is a Kalvariski. We're cousins. He doesn't know it. I'll give him a shock one day and tell him you're related to a YU Rebbe. Okay? So I'm Zayn Gesund. But my grandfather said to me, mein Einikel is Vilach Zogena Deya, my grandson, I want to give you my opinion, a viewpoint. Think it over. I don't think you should leave America and go to Israel. It's my grandfather speaking after the Holocaust. But America, the land, free, democracy, you can make money, make a living, etc. And these rabbis, wow, did they encourage it. Let me quote to you from Rabbi Leo Young. God created the new world. I am an enthusiastic United States of America citizen. Quote again, we know that this country is eminently capable of raising a generation of Jews whose personality will combine the eternal assets of Jewry with the great privileges of American citizenship. And you have to understand, Lincoln's birthday, Washington's birthday, Thanksgiving Day, all right, and I have to go further. Did the Rebbe celebrate Thanksgiving Day or didn't he celebrate Thanksgiving Day? There's no issue, no issue. I don't have to quote anyone. These ears and these eyes and this stupid mouth. You know the story. I've written it up. It's been quoted, requoted. But b'didi ha'viyuvda, I see it right in front of my eyes. It's Wednesday. The Rav that week had a wedding in Boston on Tuesday night. He couldn't come in, so he came in instead of Tuesday. Wednesday came in Wednesday. Wednesday after Shia, the Rav is, I'm sitting right here, right? And the Rav looks at his watch. Tomato, 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock in America to start a shiur. It's not Israel. Israel, the day begins early in America. 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock. So, will you be here? Will you be here? And I say, Rebbe, if you say 9 o'clock, we'll be here. But the stupid Arnold Rothkopf says to the Rebbe, Rebbe, why so early? And the Rebbe looks at me with the benign smile. He says, Arnold, don't you know what tomorrow is? Thanksgiving Day. I promised my wife will be at my sister by 2 o'clock. In other words, either Ann Gerber or Shalomit Meisner is making a Thanksgiving dinner, and the Rav had to figure out with getting to the airport, with the plane, from the plane to her house, to be there by 2 o'clock. So there's no question that the Rav celebrated Thanksgiving Day. And here, quoting from a sermon, the greatest single force for good and godliness in the world would be the source not only of opportunity but of salvation as well, and all this comes about because of the United States. And there's a footnote here, not only Young, right down the block, a few blocks away from Jewish Center, it's more than a few blocks, but an easy walk. I think it's 69th Park, Central Park West, is Spanish Portuguese Synagogue. There you have Rabbi Dr. David de Solda Poole, who is the most famous Sephardic rabbi at that moment in the United States, maybe the most famous in the whole 20th century, probably. And Dr. de Solda Poole gives a sermon on Passover about the American Passover. God freed the slaves. The Jews went out of bondage, and the entire concept of freeing the slaves is a result of the Passover holiday. America continues the biblical theme, abolishing slavery. And these Rabbanim believe with all their heart what is America about and take up the theme of slavery, abolishing slavery. And Rabbi Young again and again, quote, what delineates the United States? Kindness, justice, love thy neighbor. They couldn't be thankful enough to the United States for their freedom, for the decency of the community, being able to live, to get ahead, to succeed, and not to suffer because they are Jews. They were total, total Americans. And Yitzchak, I'll quote to you, want to welcome Rabbi Rubin back. You look better, your face, and just good health at our age, boy. That is the most important. Good health. Chazak mi'amatz. Let me quote to you Tova Lichtenstein. I've quoted it before, but let me quote it in context. She said to me, when my father became an American citizen, he gave a kiddush. When we left America to go in Aliyah, we gave a kiddush. And truer words were never spoken. Okay? And that brings us to the great question of Zionism. Question that haunts us until today. I'm happy to say there was an email waiting for me this morning thanking me for my response. And what was my response? Very simple. I got a question, a Talmud who's been listening to my shurim for years and years, very brilliant, from a very prestigious Chabad family that has a long history of learning and gatlut and Torah, great Rabbanim, Chabad Rabbanim, and Mesirat Nefesh for Yiddishkeit under the communists. It's not a small individual. I know the roots of his family. And he's a fine Talmud Chacham. And he was very upset with the Supreme Court ruling. Again, it's a replay of 1984. It's a replay of the Kahana letter. If that letter is authentic, not authentic, a forgery, not a forgery, but what the letter says, it's true. It's exactly my feelings at the, in 1984, how President Herzog interviewed to how do we form the government, interviewed every party, including Arab murderers, and refused to interview Mayor Kahana. And that's the letter that surfaced that they claim is not real. It's a forgery. That's the word they use. I would say perhaps it's not authentic. And the Supreme Court just knocked out that follower of Mayor Kahana, what's his name, Ben Ari, and the Arab murderers can remain. It's unbelievable that we're talking last week, 2 weeks ago. No, last week. So I got a, it's not a Purim joke, it happened. So it's unbelievable. So I got a letter from this Talmud, Rebbe, you're encouraging us to come in Aliyah. How can we come in Aliyah if there's no democracy in Israel? Supreme Court rulings, I wrote back. That's the way a Chabadnik writes. We have to be positive, not negative. Come and help make it better. And I described my with my family here. I'm the first one to come, but I came, my brother came, etc. We have over 120 votes. And all 120 will go to right-wing parties. 120 out of 120. Baruch Hashem, my children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, my brother's family, my family, etc., etc. All right. But there's a tremendous question. This is a Jewish state. This is Israel. This is what we dreamt about. Stores selling chaza, right or wrong? No, right or wrong? Mizra, the kibbutz, produces basalavan, that's the word they use. Tivtam, a chain of stores open on Shabbos, selling every type of tarfus in the world. This is a Jewish state. This is what we dreamt about. All right, so I can go on and on with the problems. We've lived through the problems. Do you remember Nituchei Meitim? Remember the demonstrations? I'll never forget Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik told me the story, his first visit to Israel. He comes to Israel. You know, Rabbi Aaron, how many of you knew Rabbi Aaron? He was a very edel, what would be the word, a very sensitive person. Rabbi Aaron was very, there's some people, you can tell them every, show them every type of tarfus, and they won't get upset. Reb Aharon, very sensitive. So he tells me his first trip here, he went to see his family, the Brisker Rav's family, and the Brisker Rav had one son. I went to see that son too when I came in Aliyah. He was the public figure of the family, and he was a big activist against the Tuchay Beitim. So he tells Reb Aharon, Saturday night I'm going to show you some movies. So Reb Aharon goes to his house, movies all set up, he knows he's going to show him. He showed him bodies after body, what the Chevra Kadisha took out of Hadassah, what condition they were in. He saw, you know, to show him the Tuchay Meitim, poor Reb Aharon had to go through that. Well, we had problems with Tuchay Meitim. You have problems drafting yeshiva boys, which is more important, the study of Torah, or fighting in the army. You have problems with women today. They've taken women and they've turned them into men, and there are rumors spreading in the country, which I don't want to repeat, on the last murder. If you've heard the rumors, I heard it, and I spoke with Talmidim already many miles from here. They heard it too. Ribbono shel Olam, women have become fighters, shooters, killers. What kind of wives will they make later? Just think for a minute, though. These are real problems. Then you take today the pluralism problem. The Reform want to desecrate the where the concept of mechitza began at the holy temple, at the Beit HaMikdash, the Kol Maravi. Look at the Gemara in Sukkah, Daf Nun, Nun Aleph, the whole sugya there. And that's where separation of sexes began. And they want to dance there, men and women and Torahs. God have mercy, we have problems on top of problems. So how come Rakefet is a great Zionist with every fiber in his body and he feels every Jew should be living here? All right, that's a legitimate question. The answers are obvious. Baruch Hashem, it's 1,000 times better than 50 years ago when I came in Aliyah. Who would believe that there are over 2 million Shomrei Shabbat Jews here? And even the parties that began this election campaign, running buses on Shabbos and doing everything on Shabbos, suddenly they became very quiet because the polls show that that atmosphere, that standpoint, cost them votes. So suddenly you notice, you don't hear a word, not from the Labour Party, Gabay raised in a Moroccan Shemesh Rabbisom Azar, Oisvas Azar, shake it. And the Blue and White Party, all of them raised religious. Where was guns raised? It's unbelievable where they're coming from. God have mercy, how we fail in Chinuch. I should be faulted. We fail, we rebellion, we should have a 90% success rate, not a 20% success rate. All right, let it be. Let me not criticize my colleagues, but we have forces working against us. So now you come to a very interesting dilemma. A dilemma that plays a tremendous role in the Torah world for 100 years and still haunts us. And here we have to deal with Rabbi Young, anti-Zionist. You can translate it, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the 6th Rebbe, the 7th Rebbe, anti-Zionist, and yet they become the biggest Zionists in the world. And what are we talking about? All right, this is a major issue. It doesn't, those of you who live in Meir Shearim or live in Geula, you deal with this issue every Friday when the newspapers come out in the Haredi world. 1919, Agudat Yisrael made a decision that there can never be Jewish sovereignty until Mashiach comes. And anyone who believes that the Jews can create Jewish sovereignty in the Holy Land before Mashiach is a rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, heinous, ruthless, depraved, degenerate, debauched, surreptitious, malevolent apikoros. Plain and simple. No? Take a look. 100 years later, we have 70 years of sovereignty. We are per capita the most powerful country in the world, Baruch Hashem. We have the finest economy, may even be one of the finest in the entire world, if not the finest. And remember what we're spending every month on absorbing immigrants, on defense, on research. I know what's going on. I told you, I have a grandson getting a PhD from the Technion, And I know what his research is in and what he's accomplished. And you can multiply that. No, what has happened here? Not only that, Agudat Yisrael sits in the Knesset, sits in the government. Wow. The Eidah Haredit, the Natura Kata, don't let them forget that they're big up because how can you have a Jewish state before the advent of Mashiach? So you see, we're dealing here, you can have all the theories in the world, but what simply happened was the push of history, of God running the world the way the world ran, it forced us all into a different position. Following the Holocaust, there is not an anti-Zionist alive, basically in the Torah world, outside of a fringe element. And as much as Agudat Yisrael people will claim we're not Zionist, we're not this, we're not that, but 70 years later, you all know what's going on in Agudat Yisrael. They're part and parcel of the land. Their great Rabbanim, the Litvish Rabbanim, some of the Chassidic leaders have all stated, if you're not cut out to learn day and night, you have to go into the army. Black and white, Rav Kanievsky, Rav Steinman, the Belzer Rebbe, more than that. They want to make a living today. They're breaking out into every field. They're going into science. They're students, Machon Lev, women. They're in every possible field today. The government encouraged, being paid. Machon Lev gets twice the amount from the government when they have a student who is Haredi and not just a Dati Leumi. Same thing with the universities. And you see, we've all become Zionist. I love anti-Zionism and Zion Gesund and have all your theology in the world, but live in Israel, and the reality is 99% of the time you're part and parcel of the country. And we all live it, we all see it. So you have to understand, when we start to talk about Rabbi Young and Zionism, nothing occupied the Jewish mind more in the last 100 years than Zionism. It is a movement that succeeded beyond anyone's wildest dream. Why did it have to come about the way it did? Through Theodor Herzl, through David Ben-Gurion, through Chaim Weizmann, from people who threw away Kol HaTorah Kula. I advise you to go to yutorah.org, a guy named Rakef, and go into his lectures, why it had to come about through Herzl and not through Rabbanim Gedolei Yisrael. And no one in the world has ever been able to refute the sources I cite, the midrashim I cite, and we put it all together, I hope, properly. But that's not for now. We're dealing with the reality. This is what happened. So everyone faced this dilemma. Rabbi Young was one of many, and he was publicly preaching, I'll cite him, anti-Zionist. Following World War II, he willingly accepted the miracle, and while never formally becoming a Mizrahiite, never formally becoming a card-carrying, a card-paying Zionist, few people in the world did more than Rabbi Dr. Leo Young for what he created and did within the state of Israel. And a perfect analogy is the Lubavitcher Rebbe. You think of the Lubavitcher Rebbe and everyone cites, they don't sing the HaTikvah, and the sixth Rebbe was so opposed, and the seventh Rebbe inherited the mantle of leadership and continued his father-in-law's tradition. And I told you, Chabadikim, they will not sing that tikvah. You all know what I did to Yossi Gutnick, Yesla Gutnick, a dummy named Rakefet, a billionaire. Wow, I gave him a kick that he still hasn't recovered from. You remember what I did in Australia, in Melbourne, when in the middle of my talk, 2000, a phone, there were hundreds of people, it was my major talk, and a phone rang, and they apologized. I said, no, I don't get upset. I was giving a eulogy the week before in Israel, and a phone rang in the middle. I said, I know the world is changing, but at least let the music that it rings with be the HaTikvah. And then the Yetzer Hara got the best of me, and I looked Gutnick right in the eye. I was sitting next to the president of Mizrahi, Danny Lem. It's a true story. And I said, oh yeah, wait a minute, I know you Chabadnik and don't sing Hatikva. Tell me, Yesala, do you say Matovu or Alecha every morning? And he says, of course. I said, who composed Matovu o Halecha? Bilam HaRasha. Hatikva was written with Naftali Hirtz Imba. I'm probably the only one alive today who still had a direct connection. I told you his niece was the treasurer of my sisterhood in Maplewood, South Orange. And she told me he was crazy. He was a genius. He was a Shema Shabbos. Ribbono Shel Olam, I think he was a little better than Bilam. All right. You don't sing the Hatikva? And boy, Lamb Slam gave a kick to Gutnick, and the audience broke into applause. I don't think they still sing the Hatikva, the Chabadniks. The Rebbe is more important than a dummy from Jerusalem. But very fascinating. And you see, you have to understand, Vic, you're reading me? There's a dialectical tension here. I don't want to say to you, you'll see where Rabbi Young finally hung his hat. You know where he finally hung his hat? Pole Agudat Yisrael. Pole Agudat Yisrael was the best of both worlds. You can say you're not a Zionist, you're an Agudist, and halacha lemaisa, you're the greatest Zionist in the world. Pole Agudat disappeared today. Why? Because the world changes as time moves on. Their kids either went total Litvish or they went total Gushamunim. You follow? But Pole Aguda, I remember the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. Pole Aguda. And when I came in Aliyah, I defined myself. I said, I'm totally at home. The people from Pole Aguda, the faculty in Mechala, almost all of them were Pole Aguda people. I was totally at home with them. Rumkite and Zionism, no compromise, either way. All right, nowadays you can be the firmest person in the world and you're Gush Emunim, you're Rav Kumekas Rav, you're some Yeshivat Hezda, you're Har Harmor, Ribbono Shel Olam, there's so much choice today. And even in the Haredi world, you all know what happened at 2 blocks from here in Yeshivat Hebron. 2 o'clock in the morning, Saturday night, the whole neighborhood is awakened. They're singing outside Yeshivat Hebron. They're dancing. What happened? Barzilai won the Eurovision. Ribbono Shel Olam said, I am so distant from what she looks like and their song and me too. And Yeshivat Hebron, my Yehuda, my Tar, Ora V'Simcha. All right. Now, let's quote Rabbi. You with me, Yitzchak? There's a very interesting point. By the way, the same point applies to the Rav to a certain degree. Until 1940, he was a big agudist. His hesped for Reb Chaim Moshe Grushinsky, no agudist statement was made in the United States since time immemorial that was more agudist than that hesped. And then you take a look, following World War II, the greatest religious Zionist in the world, Kol Dodi Dofek, Moriu Rebbe, and anyone who criticizes him, he didn't come in Aliyah. When he wanted to come in Aliyah, the world was not ready for him, 1935. You understand, God wanted him in America. When the world was ready for him, 1959, 1960, he already was not ready. See, that's life. The right person in the right place at the right time. When I look back at my life, I came in Aliyah 69. Had I come in Aliyah 2 years earlier or 2 years later, I might have never found myself. 69, the year BMT begins. BMT. We changed the world. That's when Rakefet, Rothkopf became Rakefet. I found my home. I found my niche. We changed the world. You follow? 2 years earlier, what? American kids are going to come and study here. Forget it. It's 2 years later, who needs Rakefet? There are 100 other guys here already who we can appoint to the faculty. But you see, timing is crucial. All right. Now let's come back to Rabbi Young. Quote, this is the 1920s. We cannot imagine a single normal Jew who could believe that mere physical restoration without spiritual renaissance could end in anything but disaster to the Jewish people and the Jewish land. You follow? That just have Eretz Yisrael back, Chalutzim, without Torah, without Shabbat, without Shmirat HaMitzvot, it will be disaster. That was his father's viewpoint. That was the viewpoint of most of his teachers in Berlin. Remember, Hildesheimer family originally were all Agudistim. Today, if you want to look at their descendants, and I know many of them, I don't think you find one Agudist among all the Hildesheimer descendants. But Agudat Yisrael, that was exactly Rabbi Dr. Leo Young's cup of tea. It united all the Jews. Who could believe the Litvisha Rosh Yeshiva, the Hasidic Rebbeim, the Germans, the Yekkes, their great Rabbanim, Herr Rav Doktor, the Chatam Sofer's family, everyone was united in Agudat Yisrael. It was wonderful. He felt at home. He was overwhelmed. He was happy. He attended the Knesiyot Gedolot in the 1920s. He was an Agudist, and a Agudist with a broad viewpoint of Torah in Derech Eretz. And I am not a Zionist, he wrote in October 1923. But nevertheless, I am not anti what is happening in Palestine. But he was not a Zionist in the 1920s. He never referred to America as an exile, as a diaspora. He did not support the effort to establish a state. He felt that the Jews could never succeed in establishing a state on their own without divine help, without Mashiach. And here, 20s to 30s, but world events led reluctantly. People like Rabbi Young had to accept the Jewish state, however imperfect it was. And I have to tell you, this goes back to 1949. It's a very important line that I just stated. However imperfect it was, there was the reality. Read the Rav's essay, Sheish Tfikot, Kol Dodi Do Fake. Jews have survived with miracles. 6 million are dead. Where did they go? Where did they turn? Who defends them? It was an imperfect state. No two ways about it. We still have to say there are imperfect matters going on here. But what a miracle. And willy-nilly, people like Rabbi Young and many others became Zionists. And this is his viewpoint. I think if you translate it to the Rav, translate it to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you start to understand all that has happened since 1945. The Lubavitchers will tell you the Rebbe was not a Zionist. And Rav Kefet will answer, correct, but no one did more for the state of Israel than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Established Kfar Chabad, established all over the country, Shluchot, Yeshivot, the Tefillin campaign, and I'll tell you further, the whole Kotel Hamaravi. I remember it like yesterday when the Kotel was redeemed. We had the whole leftist element, the whole secular element. It's a place of historic importance, archaeologically. Place to come to visit, build a museum, And the minute the Kotel opened, it opened on Shavuot 1967, the day after Shavuot, Lubavitch was at the Kotel putting on tefillin, people that visited. That had a great impact. You saw the Kotel, it's not archaeological. It's a place to daven. It's the Srid Beit HaMikdash. And you got to give the greatest credit. And I myself have been accosted twice at the Kotel, at Kutlei Sviagoi. And are you Jewish? And am I Jewish with a nose like mine? What's the question? And did you put on tefillin today? And alright, one time I had two students with me, they almost killed the people. But they're Balei Tshuva, they can't conceive of someone clean shaven, dressed in Western clothes, should be bucking shas and paiskim. They can't conceive of it. So say that, don't act arrogant. Tell them I put on tefillin. One time at JFK, I had time, I'd come early for the plane, although ultimately we were put on the earlier plane. But So we're walking through, and again, Chabad is there, and again, I'm a Kastig, did you put on tefillin, Jewish, etc.? I say, I've never missed a day of tefillin in my life. I decide to have some fun. And I said, look at me, how old am I? You don't have a question? And then I saw they don't know how to learn. These are young kids. They should have said, well, what do you mean you didn't put on tefillin? You're an orphan, you don't have a mother, you don't have a father. The first day, the funeral, particularly in Israel, where my parents were buried, my mother was buried 3 hours after she died. Certainly there's no shaila, you can't put on tefillin. Right or wrong, it's not like if it's one day the death, the next day the burial, until you come home, put on without a bracha. First day, pa'er, you have to get rid of the tefillin. I said, no, don't you question. So I don't know if they understood my question, but I answered them. I told them, look, my father died on Chol HaMoed. So Chol HaMoed, none of us put on tefillin. That's one of the great miracles of modern-day Israel. No one puts on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. The Litvisha, the Ungarisha, the Chassidisha, it's a miracle. No machlokes. And I said, my mother, I daven 5:30. My brother daven 6 o'clock. So we first found out my mother died at 7 o'clock. So we had already davened and put on tefillin. I said, but we did call my brother in Las Vegas and tell him when you wake up tomorrow morning, you can't put on tefillin. You follow? But this is Chabad. This is what they did at the Kotel. This is what they did at the Six-Day War. And you all know that the Rebbe says, "Ukomis Hashem Hashem Dekralechi." Quoted the Gemara in Brachot for Yerumi Meche, the tefillin shel rosh, kishrei tefillin. And they, every soldier they went to, do you want to put on tefillin, put on tefillin? And they're no atheist in foxholes. So you see, you can be, in theory, I'm not a Zionist, I'm not a Herzl Zionist, but Israel is Israel, Jews are Jews, we got to do whatever we can. It's different than Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, you read the memoir literature today of his Talmidim, and unfortunately many are dying already, and they describe his home. No, what's the description you get from anyone who was Rav Tzvi Yehuda's home? On the wall were pictures of his father, the Netziv, and right there a big picture of Theodor Herzl. Follow? That already is a Zionist. Theodor Herzl, I could put up a picture of Herzl if you heard my shiur. But that's different than Chabad. That's different than Dr. Young. They're not going to put up a picture of Herzl. But to help the Jews here, nothing stands in the way. Now, his biggest battle, and here too you find an interesting development in his life. His biggest battle was to fight the reform. And here, when Vic's, when did your grandparents reach America, Vic?
Late
18 months. So you're a good example too, and I'm an example. When our grandparents reached America, so reform didn't speak to them. You know, even if our grandparents already threw away Shabbos and threw away this, but reform didn't speak to them. But the generation born in America already, that went to high school in America, went to college in America, they already were targets for the reform movement. And he viewed one of his greatest goals was to battle the reform for the loyalty of the second and third generation born in the United States. And here are some quotes from him. Reform is Torahless Judaism. It's a Judaism without Torah. Well, if that's the case, why do you bother with them? Every Jew, be he of however alienated Jewishness, is dear to me. And this was one of his great goals, to take Torah, to take Judaism, and appeal to these people who conquered America. And he had a tremendous assistant, we'll come back to him in a week or two, a name that perhaps some of you will recall, Rabbi Joseph Kamenetsky, Rabbi Dr. Joe Kamenetsky. Naming anything to you, he's later the head of Torah Mesorah. This is someone who is very close to my cousin. Noah Daniel and Joe Kamenetsky had a chavruta, learned together, Borough Park Jews, wonderful Jews. And I knew Joe Kamenetsky as well through my cousin, and I taught his grandchildren. So I know who I'm talking about. We'll come back, we'll talk about him. Very fascinating individual. He became the educational director of Jewish Center. So here's a kid from a lower middle class home from Brooklyn, and he's working in Jewish Center with Rabbi Young, and here's his description of who the congregants were. Middle class Jews, always on the move, even if only from Riverside Drive to West End Avenue. In other words, they're integrated. They're moving up in the world. West End Avenue, if you know, do you know New York City? That's more prestigious even than Riverside Drive. Their weddings were announced in the New York Times. Ah, you know what that meant when we were growing up? Oh, someone in yeshiva got married, and like his wedding is announced in the New York Times, he's like in the class of a Donald Trump today. You understand? It was psychological. The New York Times, the Rav used to say, oh, the New York Times, he would quote the New York Times like it was like quoting the Bible. Rav Moshe Feinstein, read the memoir literature of his family. Every day he read the New York Times with a cup. That was his at breakfast, cup of coffee, whatever he had. The New York Times, I remember Reb Shmuel Lazer Volk, this was like the achievement. The New York Times, they kept busy with, quote, midnight suppers until the small hour parties. Also, that's part of America. I understand, I hear midnight suppers, high society. They commenced married life with 6-room flats. Not poor people. These were middle class, upper middle class people. Joe Kamenetsky called the Jewish Center, quote, a rich man's club. And here, he has to come into this world and create a Judaism that will attract them, that will speak to them. And this was one of the great challenges that he undertook. He spoke about Reform Judaism. It received its inspiration from the Gentile world, and it had its gold offering, its mutilated Judaism that would ultimately lead to the Gentile world. They reformed Judaism until nothing was left of it at all. Their synagogues were social galleries built upon the quicksand of opportunity. Their programs of Jewish education were inane self-deceptions known as Sunday school. The entire movement for Young had, quote, an appalling lifelessness, an undermining, spiritless, deadening spirituality. And he went on time and again, Reform Judaism ultimately leads only to the church. And he challenged them, I give you a robust, Americanized Torah Judaism, Torah in Derech Eretz. Join me, follow me, guarantee that our children remain Jewish. And by the way, this should be said today, with all the pluralism going on and all the brainwashing and all the Jewish agency, our representatives should get up at the Jewish agency and say, look at the Pew report. None observance, reform or conservative, leads to the church and total assimilation, a spiritual genocide. And don't give us Musa. What do you have to do with the Kotel? You go into the Vatican, there's a way you dress. You go to the Kotel, there's a protocol how a visitor, Jew or Jewish, Jew or non-Jewish, has to act at the Kotel. Our leaders should open their mouth in dignity. But this was Rabbi Young. Very powerful, very true. Assimilation, look what happened, Reform Judaism in Germany. Would anyone please stand up if he's a third or fourth generation Reform Jew? Few and far between. And that's where, you know, the outreach movement, what we spoke about last week, the industry. My greatest story with the outreach movement, there are people listening right now, my Talmidim, was one family that Taka was a third generation of Reform Jews in America, from Germany originally. And, you know, these were typical kids growing up. And no religion, but all right, you went to a Reform temple, had a rabbi, everyone tells you he's a rabbi, you have pluralism, you have choice. And the eldest brother, there were three brothers and a sister, the eldest brother finished his college. He wasn't a great student, wasn't that serious, a well-to-do home. And he decides to do a little trip, see Europe. Parents say, fine, you got your bachelor's. They support him. He goes to Europe. And while he's in Europe, he makes the cheshbon that Israel's not that far. Why not see the Jewish state? Goes to the Jewish state. Goes to the Kotel, a regular tourist, and gets a tap on his shoulder. Are you Jewish? Would you like to spend some time in Jerusalem? We have classes. All you have to do is attend morning classes, the rest of the day you have free, and you can stay in the dormitory. I believe it's Eish HaTorah, it's not our Sameh, it's Eish HaTorah. That. So the kid goes, within a few weeks he writes home, he's not leaving Israel, he's learning, he's overwhelmed, he's discovered himself. So the parents decide, there's a true story, parents decide, it's like a Tanakh story if you recognize it, the parents decide to send the next brother. Bring him back. What's the matter with him? So the next brother goes, and within a few weeks, he writes, I'm staying. Third brother goes. The girl goes. They all became Torah Jews. One brother lives here. The others are in America, but they have children living here. And the mother, you should know, the mother is still alive. But her home is not kosher. She loves her children, loves her grandchildren, is proud of them. But could you imagine, she doesn't know how to make her home kosher, can't bring herself. It's not within her psychic. Ad kedei kach. But you see, that's the exception that proves the rule. Ah, we have arrived. An issue that haunts us at this very moment. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, it's unbelievable. Women. Who is a woman? What is a woman? We never had a problem with it. The Marshar is named of Shmuel Edels. His mother, he was widowed. His mother raised him, Edels. You give covet. The name Chayat. Chayas, whatever way you pronounce it. It all goes back to a lady named Chaya who was a dominant figure in the family, and you honored her by taking her name as the last name. We never had a problem with women. Although I will admit, when you say Eshet Chayil, I remember Nechama Leibowitz always used to joke around with me on Eshet Chayil, as Zichrona Tzadeket Levracha, I have a privilege, I knew great people in my life. Michael, I should have amounted to something, considering the people I knew, but all right, what can I say? So she says, do you really want your daughters to be like the Eshet Chayil? Take a look. They did all the business. They ran the house. They ran the city. Where the heck were the men? They're sitting around B'shah. I hope they're learning. You follow me, Dov? Look at Eshet Chayil. Take it literally. All right. Where are the men? So where is a woman? Where is a woman? And you see, we've struggled with this. It's not just giving the women the right to vote. The women go out of the house. Nowadays, and I was blessed with many grandchildren, only one granddaughter, and I have many granddaughters-in-law today. All my granddaughters-in-law have professions. I think all of them make more money than I do, plain and simple. This one is a designer, this one is an artist, this one is a medical doctor, this one is getting a PhD in human resources. This one is an international lawyer. This one is a lawyer, deals in medical ethics. I can't believe it. And they all have careers. They're all out of the house. They all have children. Who raises the children? You take a kid of 3 months, he's in a ma'on. My wife goes hysterical. She can't handle it. The kid in the ma'on. And yet the kids seem to turn out fine. My eldest grandchildren already are in the second grade, third grade, great-grandchildren. And Kanayin Hara, Ma'on, Shma'on, this, that. All right, this is a critical issue. And today, the women, and you can't live in a bubble. My wife is in a bubble. She believes a woman's place is in the home. She has to raise the children. Well, go back 100 years, they were struggling with the same problem. What is the role of a woman? And here you have the Americanization, the women, the conservative movement, the reform movement. What? You put women behind the machitza. You make women walk up the balcony. They're the equal of man. How do you do a thing like that? And Jewish Center, you have an additional level. The families are well-to-do. The women don't work. What is the role of the woman? The house, the children, the husband. The man comes home. You all know Jackie Mason's line. The guy is at work and he's a big shot and everyone kowtows to him. Mr. Boss, how are you? Mr. Boss, how are you? He walks in the door. His wife says, Yankala, take out the garbage. All right, that's not the way a Jew should. A husband walks in, Yankala, how are you? Sit down and bring a cup of coffee. How was the day? Please, we have a wonderful supper. Relax, don't worry about the business. But now there's another factor. See, all this, 100 years ago, it's what we take. We've gone through many different cycles. But 100 years ago, people... Women, you don't have to churn butter anymore. Even in the United States, you can get Breakstone's butter. These are all Jewish companies, all right? I don't want to say it's Chalav Yisrael, but the butter's available. The cottage cheese is available. All right, they had a kasher meat. Today, which woman kashes meat? I mean, I told you, recently. Mm-hmm. The world has changed so much today that even the problem that Charlie and I had when we came in Aliyah ages ago, the meat that was nisht upgegissen, you follow, imported frozen. So the whole shaila, it was frozen for 2 weeks. You have to wash it every 72 hours. So all right, the whole machlokes poskim. I ate the meat. The rav said, what kind of shaila? Nothing keeps the meat fresher than freezing it. Today they kasher the meat in Europe, I understand. Some of it, if not all of it already. But they kasher the meat where they slaughter it, because no housewife is going to kasher it, so it doesn't pay already to send without kashering. Kasher it already, get it done, and know that there's no shaila whatsoever. So Here you have a woman, what about all the spare time she has? It's not like Anna Tefka, it's not like Fiddler on the Roof, where the woman has to milk the cow, churn the butter, make the cheese, bake the bread. My wife here in Israel today, we've come full cycle. We're going back 200 years. Challah, all the balat shuvah and all the outreach. 100 women come together with a big ceremony and bake challah and take off challah. It's unbelievable. My wife says, you got to be crazy to bake today. You can buy for 15, 16 shekel the finest challah in the world. You can buy the finest bread in the world. You can buy the finest cookies and cakes in the world. Kanayin hara. But what do you do with the women? And here, Rabbi Young, they say the secret of his success was his wife, Irma Rothschild, was her maiden name, if I'm not mistaken. She was the power behind the throne. In other words, he spoke to the women. He knew the power of the women. But the women had time. Women weren't to work. Women are to run the house. Women are to volunteer. They had to do all the chesed that was required in the synagogue. The ladies' auxiliary, or later what you would call the sisterhood, they were the conscience, they were the heartbeat of the goodness of the synagogue. And he was the one that channeled that constructively. And I have to say, in my rabbinate, which already was not exactly the 1920s, the 1960s, but the heartbeat of my synagogue was the sisterhood. No two ways about it. And here quotes from him. The Jewish sentiment are busy making money and the women spending it. All right? An interesting quote. Tell me, who uses this today in all her talks? What's her name? Tamima Mizrahi. Tamima Rothschild Mizrahi. She's turned, she takes the women attitudes. What are you correcting? Yamima. Yamima is her name? Yamima, thank you, not Tamima. I'm making her too Tamima. She's not Tamim. She went to Chorev. She was a classmate of one of my daughters. It's amazing what Chorev has turned out. Great, great, great women. And she speaks, and they say part of her charm is not just her knowledge, but that she doesn't put femininity down. And she'll take shopping and turn it into a sacred undertaking for a woman to relax, to see the world, to see the new fashions, what interests her. And it's an interesting quote. The Jewish sentiment are busy making money and the women spending it. Here's a more powerful quote. Woman is here to cleanse men spiritually from the grime of daily competition. Woman is here to comfort men from the hundredfold miseries of money making. And there's a lot to be said for that. A man out in the world, there's tension, there's business, there. People aren't honest in business. If you meet an honest businessman, you have to make a shechayonu. Charlie Bentheim, I told the story, let me tell it again, but if you heard it 2 years ago, it's kedai hearing it again. This is an absolute true story. These ears heard the story from Charlie himself, but others talk about it. Late 1930s, Charlie Bentheim, Upper West Side, what we're talking about. He didn't belong to Rabbi Yangshu, he belonged to Spanish Portuguese. So Charlie, in the late 30s, his father Zygmunt, this big Jewish Torah businessman, Zygmunt gets a check for $25,000 from Germany. And he says to Charlie, Charlie told me he never held a check for so much money in his hands. He was a kid of 17. He says to Charlie, go to our bank and tell the president, I want this money put into a separate account. 7 years go by, the war is over, 1946, 47. The secretary tells Zygmunt, a man is here to see you. It's obviously a survivor. Man comes in from Germany. And he speaks to Charlie, and he says to him, did you get a check for this amount of money in 38, 39? And Charlie says, yes. And the man starts to cry. And Charlie says to him, "Why are you crying? I have the money." And the man says, "Mr. Bentheim, I want you to know I come from the Hirschian school, and when I saw what was happening with Hitler, I researched three Orthodox businessmen, and my secretary, treasurer, made up phony invoices as if I owe them money for imports. And Hitler was insistent that you have to pay up all your bills, not to embarrass the German nation. And we were able to send this money. My idea was, I don't know what's going to happen, but if I should survive, I should have money to start all over. Do you know I've gone? You're the third person I came to, the last one. The other two denied ever receiving it." And Charlie took him to the bank, got him started in business, added money to it, says, "When you succeed, you'll pay me back." And that's Charlie Bentheim. How many people do you see like that? This is, it hurts, but that's the reality. But the woman has to be there to help. Now, Rabbi Young took the bull by the horn, and recognizing this situation with the woman, the home, the spare time, two major themes became dominant in his outreach and guidance to women. Number one, volunteer work. Once you have some spare time, utilize it for the good of the community. And the sisterhood becomes the heartbeat of Jewish Center. The other concept is obviously one that Rabbanim never knew how to articulate in the United States. You wouldn't find an Agudas HaRabbanim who could handle it, but Rabbi Young was eloquent. Taret Mishpacha. He wrote about it. He published in his select Jewish library. You'll find articles on Taret Mishpacha. Time and again he preached to avoid sexual excesses, quote, end quote. Time and again he preached the importance of Taret Mishpacha. And this is during the Jazz Age. This is when America is starting to throw away the Victorian concept of prudence and sneered, and all that went into sex before the 1920s. Took 100 years, but today in the United States we're basically walking naked. We're like animals. There's no distinction. Female, male, God have mercy where we're at. You have no idea where we're at. Show you some of the freebies in a minute. But he took the bull by the horn, and he was basically the first American Rav to be able to speak in dignity and publicly about Taret Mishpacha. And this is why in Manhattan you always had a very large, well-kept mikveh on the Upper West Side. You did not have a mikveh on the Upper East Side. Everyone from the East Side went across Central Park and used the West Side mikveh. This is a credit to Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. So my dear students, we've said a few words today. We've got a lot more to go. We're rolling. We're recreating a man. And time moves on. We forget. We have our own problems. But somehow I consider it a mitzvah. I can support my viewpoint well. Shalavich v'yagedcha sekeinecha v'yomru lach. If you don't know your past, you're not going to be able to build a beautiful future. And there's a world we can learn from Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. So we saw today, I would say, the concept of his Zionism and non-Zionism, very important. We're going to come back to it. We're going to see what he did in Israel and what he did across the world. The attitude towards women, the battle with reform. What a fascinating individual. A man not born here, Hungarian origins, German influence, English influence, and yet no one succeeded like he did on the Upper West Side of New York. Rabbi Rubin, what is troubling your young mind?
When you explained the often that the day school did not work in the Jewish center,
right.
Why did it work on the east side?
No, we're talking Jewish center 1921-22. And you're talking Ramaz 1935, 1936, 1937. It's a different period. I explained that last week. Same thing with Maimonides. The Rav was before his time. But once he organized it, Ramaz was in New York, the Rav was in Boston, and they both caught on. You follow? They both caught on, and the same thing in Baltimore. At this time, Baltimore already has the first day school outside New York City. It took a third generation to wake up to the day school.
Manhattan
Day School, I believe it begins in the mid-30s or the end of the 30s. But Manhattan Day School, the time was ripe. And I tell you, after World War II, it certainly intensified many ways over. I just want to show you a picture that was sent to me. This is Rabbi Goldstein. This is Rabbi Adams. Does anyone know who that man is? It has to be a balabus. Anyone know anyone from the West Side who's in his 80s today? I'd like to try to establish who that is. All right, I guess you're youngsters, so let it be. My dear students, before I give out the freebies, allow me to reward myself. I don't get a big salary. I never got a big salary in my life, and at my age, I don't need a big salary anymore. But to talk to intelligent people and let off steam, that I'm allowed to do. So I have to tell you, it was a very fascinating trip. My son-in-law and eldest daughter took myself and my wife and showed us Venice, then we were in Milan. We got a feel of Italy. Milan is very, not Milan, Venice, every Jew in the world should see, because it's very unique. You can travel all over the world. Essentially, every city is the same. The language may be different. They're wealthy areas, they're poorer areas, they're middle-class areas, they're fancy shops, there's popular shops. Venice is a city built entirely on water. I couldn't believe it. You can't bring a car in. And that was my wife's dream in high school in Ramaz. Her year they put on Gilbert and Sullivan, some play with a gondola and what do they call it? Am I pronouncing it right?
A gondolier
and going through the water. So here we are going, my wife achieving her dream. And I have to thank my children. It really, really was something. To see the Jewish community there is unbelievable, because that was the first ghetto ever established. The ghetto still stands. Today anyone can live there. There are three different shuls, actually there are four, but three that we toured that survive hundreds and hundreds of years old. And that too is fascinating. And anyone in the kahila seems to be frum. It's a kahila that remained frum throughout the millennium, plain and simple. Then there the modern world. Chabad is there. Chabad is there. Well, I asked this people studying at yeshiva, they're learning Yeredeya for smicha. Young people in their early 20s, some are from Brooklyn, some from Israel, one already from Brooklyn, had been in Australia, Sydney, now he's there. And I asked, so why did you come here? Ribbono shel Olam, you can sightsee, but that takes a week, why? So they explained to me that, and this I read about, that Venice gets hundreds of thousands of Jewish visitors every year. And it is something unbelievable. You go to the bus, it means a water bus. Everything like you have stops for the train, for buses here, they're on the water. The platform where you're waiting is shaking up and down. It's amazing. Ambulances go by on the water. Things being delivered on the water. You can't use a car. It's all water, bridges here. It's different than anything you could imagine. So they tell me, hundreds, I read 300,000 Jews. I say, I can't believe 300,000 Jews visit every year. All right, if not 300,000, 200,000, 100,000, but quite a few. So there are two hotels that cater to Jews. There's a restaurant, Gam Gam. There's a Milchika restaurant. There's a bakery, all 100%. And the pizza place, all 100%. So we try to daven in the Svadik shul. We're told 8 o'clock, but in the hotel, they thought, we don't guarantee you minyan. We got to the shul. With my son-in-law and myself, we were 5 people. So we understood already. Chabad, we couldn't daven. They started 10 o'clock. I couldn't believe my eyes, my ears at 9:30. How can you daven so late? So we daven mincha maariv at Chabad. And let me tell you that I have a shock. Here's a picture of the Aron HaKodesh. You can come closer. You don't have to sit so far. Mm-hmm. Here's a picture of the Aron HaKodesh. 770, a picture of 770. On top, Yechi Adoneinu Moreinu Rabbeinu Melech HaMashiach Le'olam Va'ed. Here is the flag, the Messianic flag. And on the wall, this wall here, is a tremendous picture of the Rebbe. And I have to tell you, it's just beyond words. Literally, avodah zara.
Recite that in 772.
No, 770, there's a big machlokes, but it's...
There's also in the base of Medrash.
But not the Aron HaKodesh. Nishtat kedei kach. There's a big thing, they let them go, they took it down, there was a fight, they called the police, and you have no idea what's going on in 770. The old-time Chabadnikim, who were the Rebbe's right hands, have guards around the clock to protect them. You can't get any, you have to ring, they have to know who you are. You don't know what's going on there. But, so, you know, you should know, the whole trip back, I kept on thinking, what's a greater disgrace? The Talmidim of Mori Rebbe, who went left-wing, and God have mercy, what they're... The whole question of homosexuality and the women and the service and the shul and the chazaniyot and all the avodah zarah here, and I tell you, I'm so troubled either way you look at it. But it shows you in the modern world there's so much outside influence that you can't win it all. Even the greatest people in the world, take a look. This isn't the name of Chabad, the name of Torah. They disgrace the Rebbe's memory, disgrace Chabad. It's so thwarting, frustrating. And again, we were there just a few days, so it's not shy to ask questions, to argue. Milan, very interesting, a whole Jewish area, a kosher pizza place with more food, sushi. I don't think there's a fleshika place in Milan, but Milchik's there is. And the whole Jewish community, everyone there speaks Hebrew, Italian, and then we look, this picture, you'll have to look close, that's the day school in Milan, and right in front of it, you'll see an army jeep, there it is, and patrol around the clock by army people, from the Italian government. And I'm told in Rome it's the same story. So I have to say, we have problems here, they have problems there. But nothing compares to this. I have to be very thankful. Whatever's happened over the years, certain elements have shifted gears. But I picked up a student who I have a great affinity to, because of my work in the Mossad. The truth of the matter is, had I not worked in Russia, communist Russia, from 1980 to 1990, Yomo would have Rebbe hitting him over the head and bothering him and demanding from him. But Yomo has a Rebbe who eats out of Yomo's hands. Right or wrong, I have to be honest, a kid from Russia learning Torah. Here I am in Milan. And I'm approached, Rabbi Rakefet, don't take me too seriously now. What do you want to do in honor of your dear student, Yomo? And I said right away, I want to name a commodity in his honor. And here we are in Milan. You can't believe it. I see it. I told my daughter, take a picture. All right, I have, if anyone wants, I have copies here. Here it is. Yomo. Michael, do you see it? Yomo in Milan, in his honor. Notice an Arabic woman, a Muslim woman, is walking, which is another part of the puzzle. The Arabs will take over all of Europe. You walk through Venice, you walk through Milan, and we walk miles and miles and miles. I mean, Kaddish Baruch Hu, that my feet held down, and you don't see any pregnant women. It's like children don't exist. Then you see a Muslim family, four kids, five kids, mm-hmm. Italians. They live in Italy, have the right to vote. So let me tell you, I've been to England I gave up on 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I can't believe what Trafalgar Square looked like. Paris is lost already. If you go to France, you'll think you're in a third world country. But here we are in Germany, and there is the big truck honoring Yomo, and right in front of it is an Islamic building. Italy, exactly. Now, before we forget, I want to remind you, I'm teaching next week, I'm teaching next Monday, Bezrat HaNatan Yov Koach. I want everyone here. I'll ask you next week if you'll come a week afterwards. If you tell me you'll come, I'll teach. But if you say no, we're busy, because the week afterwards already is Chodesh Nisan, Bet Gimel. So if you tell me you're busy getting ready for Pesach, I understand. Does anyone want this? I would love an intelligent person to take this and tell me your point of view. It's Yosef Mizrahi on all of Agatha and Shas. Very interesting. My take on him is he's good, he's powerful, he knows the generation. In my humble opinion, he's oversexed. His understanding of Israel as one who grew up here, born here, is totally negative, doesn't understand what democracy is about and how he can change the country, not by running away to Queens. But nevertheless, he made Rabbi Rachmim, who was my Talmud for a number of years, he made Rabbi Avraham Frum, so interesting. Speaking of the Rebbe, this is on the Rebbe about college education. And it's unbelievable today that a lot of people, Dennis Prager, quotes the Rebbe, quotes this letter, oppose the sending the kids to college. Kushner reads the Megillah in the White House, and his Chabad Rebbe says he read it perfectly. Very interesting article sent to me by Rabbi Rubin. Did the Talmud really say to get drunk on Purim? What does it mean? Could be, Charlie, if you put on underarm deodorant and go to sleep, right? There could be a yotze. Could be. This is an unbelievable, the greatest Purim costume. It took me a long time to figure it out. Here's a family on Purim. Look what they look like. And here's what the family really looks like. Unbelievable. Supreme Court, if you know what's going on with Newport Synagogue and Spanish Portuguese, the Supreme Court refused to get involved. They're letting the lower court decision stand. So the Spanish Portuguese Synagogue owns all the treasures in the Newport Synagogue. This is in London, the Jewish Museum of London, a whole display on how people think the Jews are only involved in money lending. It's to show how anti-Semitism developed. This is New York, which I can't believe. Will New York City get real casinos? They need money, they need taxes, they want to bring casinos to New York, to the state. Ribbono shel Olam, the mafia is going to dance on the tables. Here's the Rebbe's advice, very interesting. We lived this. Charlie, you may have been here already, how Chabad comes to on Purim, gets to Shechem against their throwing rocks, and the Rebbe said you have to go, and how they're dancing with the soldiers. This is a very fascinating picture. No one identified Ksirei Mizrahi and Branov. I wonder if that is in Branovich, 1928. It's an interesting, interesting picture. Yomo sent me this, and then Steve Gross sent it to me. This is very... Yitzhak, we just quoted something you sent.
David Newman sent it to me to send it.
David Newman sent it to Yomo to send to me, and Steve Gross sent it to me. Very sad. The alleged sexual abuse victims at Yeshiva University preparing lawsuit. In other words, what we thought was past history, it seems New York State now did something legally that there's no time clause. It doesn't expire. And if that's the case, the whole group of students got together, 34 former pupils, got lawyers, and they're suing the yeshiva in Manhattan Supreme Court against what they claim happened with two individuals. God have mercy what that can do to yeshiva.
Why do they sue the school? Why do they sue those people?
Because the one of them is dead already. The other one lives in Israel. There's no one to sue. But I don't know if you can sue individuals, but you can sue the institution for not taking steps of precaution years ago.
The institution know?
Listen, it's a sad story. I don't want to go into it now, but the institution knew and didn't know. The problem is that the Rav, why didn't the Rav go to the police when he found out about certain individual who he knew from time immemorial from the Boston area? Of course, you didn't go to the police. It wasn't in your mentality. You can't judge the 1980s by the standards of today.
Somebody in Maimonides that...
Not Maimonides, someone from the Boston area, NYU. The Rav said to him, you have to get out. He threw him out. That's why he went in Aliyah. He's dead. But the Rav didn't go to the police. Rabbi Lam didn't go to the police. What can I tell you? I know a guy named Brett Kefik. In 1971 or 72, a girl came over to him in Machon Gold and confided in him what some other faculty member who's dead, who made believe he never went to YU, Chas v'Chalila, so YU grad, but too firm today to me. And what he said to her, it slaughtered her. That this is a Rebbe talking to a girl, God have mercy. And I comforted her, I spoke with her, I encouraged her. Until today, she gives Shvut, she and her husband give Shvut to me, thousands of dollars a year in my honor. You follow? But I didn't, I should have gone to the dean and said to the dean, get rid of that mamsa or I'm resigning. You follow me? I didn't, because it wasn't in your mentality. To judge Rakefet of 72 by the theories of 2022 is not fair. So they're going to go to court. It's going to cost YU a fortune, and God have mercy. If they award, they'll award millions and millions. And the Catholic Church, and God knows what it wants. May Indian read the Yoto Indian. Michael Steinhardt, it's hard to believe. This is a New York Times investigative reporting. This man, a billionaire, and God, what a vulgar mouth. I can't believe what I'm reading. That Steinhardt, Robert Kraft apologizes. Robert Kraft tells, I am truly sorry. This is Maimonides. That's where you come from, Yitzchak. Two copies, beautiful article, Fall Out of Chernobyl, how a Jew, I've met him from Queens, who is a Chernobyl, an Enikel, a Tversky, a businessman. He's a CEO of a company. He's not involved in being a Rebbe. But he sought out the little Sefer Torah that was in his family, a Sefer Torah this big, and he finds it with a family in Israel, cousins, totally irreligious, caught up in the Zionist dream. And what a story, how he raises the money to buy it. Yitzchak, take this. Yitzchak, you give this to Yitzchak. This is for Michael Miller. This is unbelievable on how the Yankees got Stanton, the inner politics. Young Israel, bitter fight in America over Young Israel being too right-wing with the Israeli government. Interesting article. Book of Esther, does it belong in the Bible? Bernard Rebel Graduate School, the Satmar Rav, they're having a lecture, The Genealogy of Radical Orthodoxy and the Deconstruction of Religious Zionism. All right, I hope to prepare lectures on the same topic. We'll see what he says and if Rakepit is any better or any worse. The Rebbe, very fascinating. Shazar, his relationship with President Shazar and Rabbi Mindel, that was the Rebbe's expert in writing letters in English, correspondence between him, the Rebbe, and Shazar. Very bad news to the yeshiva in New York, very good news for Aliyah. The Board of Education is determined to see to it that the yeshiva introduce secular learning like any other high school. Very sad, Illinois House votes to require LGBT history curriculum taught in schools. Chicago, are you listening? We need you in Israel. Yale President, Normie Gold sent me this, I already knew about it, but I couldn't believe reading it. Yale President, who's a Soloveitchik, discovers his link with Jesus-loving Rabbi Soloveitchik. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. The Beit HaLevi, one son, went way off the derech and published a book on the interconnection between the Old Testament and the New Testament. I want to add one word that Rabban Soloveitchik told me. He met a great-great-grandson, and he said he's a Baal Tshuva on the West Coast. Yitzhak Rubin sent this to me, the highlights of Israel's good news, and boy, if this is fabulous to read. It reminds me of my Mechutins, which addressed in peace, Isli Ackerman. He used to buy the Palestinian Jerusalem News every day, their English newspaper. I say, Isli, why don't you buy the Jerusalem Post? He says, what are you, crazy? The Jerusalem Post, this problem, that, even look at the part. I saw headlines today, God, the country's falling apart. The Palestinian News, the most powerful army in the world wants to attack us, the greatest anti-Arab people in the world. Wow, if half of that is true, we're doing okay. Five more Brooklyn yeshivas allow students to attend school unvaccinated with measles. Did you hear the news this morning? Who went shopping in Osherat and Givat Shaul this past Thursday between 10 to 2 in the afternoon? Call the Board of Health immediately. People with measles were in the store. This is the Lubavitcher Rebbe editing a Pasher overview. Very fascinating to see his command of English and how he corrects the English submitted to him. This is commentator, which I wish someone would explain to me. They announced that they're cutting down on the requirements of the required courses in the morning divisions, Judaic studies, so that more students will come to school. And here's an article, what it's like to be a Chabad woman in a Muslim-majority country in Morocco. This is a shlucha to Morocco, and what it's like to live there. Unbelievable Jews still there, shluchim going, kala kala. The saddest is the last one. You won't believe where we're at. This is a legal document submitted to the Court of New York by Dr. David Schwartz. Dr. David Schwartz is a Lubavitcher who deals with psychological problems. He's involved in correction therapy for homosexuals, lesbians, based in bisexual, non-sexual. God have mercy where we're at. He's not allowed to practice. People can't come to him. He can be thrown into jail. This is a legal document now submitted to the court demanding the right to practice if people come to him out of their own free will. Anyone who has any legal training here will appreciate this document. Let's see what the court rules. I want to thank you very much for your participation and my heart. B'leva nefesh, a big thank you. And Yomo, can you believe, will you send your parents a copy of this? Let me hear. Yes or no?
No.
You better send your parents.
They don't.
Give them a little nachat.
They don't
call me Yomo. They don't know me as Yomo.
They don't know you.
They know people call me that.
One second. So not their cup of tea. Yeah. Oh boy. And what about in YU back home? Who was your Rebbe? Give me a name. No, a name. Who do you relate to?
I could send it to Rebbe Willick.
Baruch Hashem. It will be sent to
Rebbe.
He will be sent to Rabbi Willick and send him my best regards. Okay? Got it?
Belina.
And to we meet again in health and happiness, das vedanya. Do me a favor, Charlie. Take a picture of Yomo, one of those sheets, to show to Charlie when he gets, to show to Morty when he gets back. No, you don't need a picture. Can I have it printed here?
Oh, you have another one?
Yeah.
Seven of them here. Six or seven.
Rabbi Akefa, I went to Camp Ben Yisrael for 10 summers in Michigan, and there was a picture of the Rebbe on the Mizrach wall. And as I got older, it bothered me, so I stole it. I took it off the wall and hid it because I couldn't stand it. But also, as the years went on in camp, they added the Harachaman Hu Yivarech as the name of Morena Barabenu. Not Melech Hashem, but they did add that Harachaman, and he loved that stuff. He liked all right. The people called the Mashiach.
All right. I don't.
Rabbi, I have to the other thing about the Rebbe, thank God.